Podmoth.
If you're easily offended, this show may not be for you.
But if you're into that weird fun sh**, you've come to the right place.
You've been warned.
Are you there?
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic. Okay, stories. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to BSP, Believer Skeptic Podcast.
The podcast where two idiots debate weird phenomena.
I'm Chris, I'm the believer.
I'm Cody, I'm the skeptic.
And if this is your first time listening to us, we're an LGBTQ paranormal comedy podcast and proud members of the Podmoth Network. And this is a full episode, and we're back.
We're back. Yay. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah. We've been all over the place the last couple of weeks, but I just literally got back yesterday, flew in last night, so I'm a little tired, but
excited because we have a really great topic.
And I'll preface this whole episode, it's gonna hit me in the feels quite a bit because it's gonna be hard for me.
Yeah, this is something really important to Chris. I think it's awesome, so it's going to be really nice. And yeah. I know it was sounding laughy at the beginning, but Chris shared this beef jerky that he got from New Mexico, and we were both joking on
it's
it.
Full of pepper and hot pepper.
Yeah, so. And literally right before we hit record, we're both like.
So this episode.
Well, should we say what we are first? Did we do that for full episodes?
Okay, explain what a full episode is, Cody.
A full episode is a full episode. The end. And we pick a paranormal topic. Tonight, it's going to be really eclectic today. It's going to be great. And we share stories and information about it. And then Chris talks about why people believe. And then I debunk the crap out of it. And this one, well, I mean, I bring a debunk to this, but not to the actual topic, but to my individual stories.
So I'll introduce the topic since it was my thing. Last year, a lot of my heroes passed away. And one that hit me the hardest was Anne Rice, just because she's done a lot for me.
She really has, especially even for like your LGBT identity for you, right?
I'll talk about that later. But yes, we're doing a tribute in memoriam of Anne Rice, who passed away in December. So we're just taking some of her supernatural elements and doing stories on everything. That's why it's so eclectic.
Yeah, because anything she wrote about was fair game. And let me go ahead and preface my own thing is to say, I've never read an Anne Rice novel, and so this was Chris's thing, and so I had to ask him for ideas. But that way, don't judge me too harshly, Anne Rice fans, because I greatly respect her and what she did, and I know Chris will talk about her, but I admittedly am not thoroughly knowledgeable about her. So
no, you have to.
Yeah, now I'm going to learn.
Yeah. So with that, drinks?
Drinks.
You go first, since you forgot your drink and we had to go pick it up, but I still didn't see it. So.
We did. Yeah, I got here and I walked in and I was like, Chris, I forgot my drink. Yeah. So I was going to go ahead. There's a wine called Storyteller, and I was going to pick it up, but I've used it before. Yeah. And so I ended up coming across this, and it's called, and just look at this. It looks like an Anne Rice novel to me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it's called Prayers of Sinners. And even that just sounds like something she would write about. And then I read the back where it says, one's true self lies somewhere between a virtuous good side and an indulgent dark side.
Oh, that's perfect. That explains me too.
Doesn't it, right? And doesn't it sound like, because I've seen Interview with a Vampire, and I'm sure a lot of her stories deal with the good
that
and the bad.
Turmoil. Yeah. In inner turmoil.
Yeah. Especially indulging yourself, you know? And so I saw this and I was like, oh, this is the absolute perfect wine. So I think Anne Rice inspired me because I already picked out the Storyteller and I was walking away. And this was like on a bottom shelf and it just caught my eye. So while Chris does his ass flavored drink.
It did not taste as good as I thought it would, but... like we said, she's written about many a supernatural creatures, but she's probably most famous for her vampires. So I'm not using an Anne Rice vampire, but the recipe is called Dracula's Blood Punch.
Cool. And okay, does it have anise in it?
No.
It doesn't, because I walked in and I was like, I either smell anise or meat.
I couldn't find cherry meat. Ew.
Like, this is a friend's trifle.
I couldn't find regular cherry juice, so it's the dark cherry juice. So it's cherry juice infused with orange peels, chili, cinnamon, clove, ginger, and then some agave.
So I guess for history, you're going to talk about her life?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a little condensed because I could have written her biography.
Yeah, I know nothing about her. And you said, like, I'm going to be surprised by this.
Yeah, because there's some connections that you'll make personally with her.
Really? Mm-hmm. Did she write Nancy Drew as well?
No.
Aw. Okay.
All right. So Howard Allen Francis O'Brien was born on October 4th, 1941 in New Orleans to Howard O'Brien and Catherine Ellen O'Brien.
So Anne nor Rice are anywhere in her name.
I'll get there.
Okay.
She was of Irish Catholic descent and was the second of four daughters. One other, Ellis Bocart, was also an author who's also passed away. She was initially named after her father, but on her first day of first grade, when a nun asked her her name, she replied Anne, which she thought was a pretty name. And her mom didn't bother to correct her. So from that day forward, she would be known forever by that name, which was legally changed in 1947. To add on to that, when she was confirmed at the age of 12, her name became Howard Ellen Francis Alphonsus Ligori O'Brien. She's Catholic.
I was going to say, this is my little sister's name.
Yeah.
That is quite the name. And I love how she just randomly throws out Anne. It's a child and everyone's like...
And her
like,
mom's like, I'm not going to correct her. Yeah. Yeah. 3 years later, Anne's mother would die from alcoholism.
Oh,
and soon after, her father enrolled her and her sisters in an all-girls private Catholic school. Anne's father would eventually remarry and move the family to Richardson, Texas.
What?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. Do you know where that is?
Oh my God. I've driven through it a billion times. It's literally the first suburb just north of the Dallas proper. So anytime you drive anywhere in the Dallas Metroplex, you drive through Richardson.
Yeah. I tell you, you're going to have a lot of personal connections.
Oh, that's so cool.
While in Richardson High School in a journalism course, she would meet the love of her life, her future husband, Stan Rice.
So Anne and Stan Rice?
Yeah.
Okay.
Following graduation from high school, Anne went to Texas Women's University for 1 year and then transferred to North Texas State College. She completed one more year there but dropped out due to financial reasons. Not long after that, she decided to move to San Francisco and stayed with a friend's family until she was able to find a job and some financial stability. After being employed, her and her friend moved to the Haight-Ashbury District in San Francisco. She and her friend began to attend night courses at the University of San Francisco, which at the time was an all-male school that allowed women to take night courses.
Oh, wow. That's
allowed.
Okay. Allowed.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
While taking some time off, she went back to Texas and began talking to Stan Rice again. She then returned to San Francisco, where Stan Rice visited her but had to return to Texas. Not too long after that, she received a special delivery letter from Stan proposing to her. Yeah.
Oh, what? Is this weird?
I mean, it was in the 50s and 60s, so things were a little bit different.
That's true. So they really weren't even...
No.
Okay.
Yeah. The couple married in 1961 in Denton, Texas.
I bet he proposed with See's candy. That's old, right?
I don't know.
It's like old candy. So they got married in Denton.
When she was 21 and he was 19.
Which is the asshole of the Metroplex.
I've been to Denton.
Okay. Anyone who's from Denton, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Following their marriage, they moved to San Francisco just in time for the hippie revolution. Although Anne considered herself a square and didn't involve herself much in the movement. Anne would then get her BA in political science from San Francisco State University. 2 years later, their first child, Michelle, would be born in 1966. Anne returned to San Francisco State 3 years later to complete her MA in creative writing, where her husband, Stan, would become faculty after earning his MA in creative writing as well.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Eventually becoming a chair of the department.
I'm so out of it. I thought you said eventually he became a chair.
The
and
chair
I was like, he
of
turned
the department.
In, I was like, what? Okay.
Sadly, in 1970, their daughter Michelle was diagnosed with a type of leukemia, which she would succumb to 2 years later, just before she turned six.
Oh, that's sad.
On that, Anne stated she had a prophetic dream a few months before in which her daughter would become ill, dying from, quote, something wrong with her blood.
Oh, my gosh.
In her grief, Anne would start writing Interview with a Vampire, which would be published in 1976.
So the little girl in Interview with a Vampire, that was probably
That's the next thing I'm going to say.
Oh.
Anne would later state that her daughter was the inspiration for the vampire Claudia in her novels, and that the infamous Lestat was inspired by her husband, but was a combination of him and herself.
God.
Yeah.
So in the book, Claudia gets to be immortal. No, which is
remember,
what?
Interview the
Vampire. Oh, she died. Oh, that's yeah. right. She gets burned. Okay. Yeah.
1 year later, in 1978, their son Christopher would be born. A year after his birth, Anne and Stan would both quit drinking alcohol, breaking the familial pattern she had grown up with.
Good.
Fast forward to 1988, Anne and Stan moved back to New Orleans, where they would make their permanent home. 10 years later, after being an atheist for many years, she would return to Catholicism. That same year, she fell into a diabetic coma that almost caused her death. This would not be her first brush with death, as in 2004, after gastric bypass surgery, she almost died from a bowel obstruction.
Wow. So she is Catholic, even with her writings and stuff?
And I will get there.
Oh, that's so fascinating. Yeah.
Despite her Catholicism, Anne Rice would become a huge advocate for LGBTQ rights, good, abortion, and birth control. In 2002, Rice passed away from brain cancer, which prompted her to sell her homes in New Orleans and move to California to be closer to her son, Christopher. In 2010, Anne announced that she would no longer be a Christian. Although committed to Christ, she couldn't associate herself with, as she put it, the, quote, quarrelsome, hostile, disputatious, and deservedly infamous group, unquote.
Wow.
Later, she would clarify that Christ would still be central to her life, but not in the way he is presented by organized religion.
You know what? That I get that more than you understand.
Yeah. Last month, on December 11th, 2021, Anne Rice passed away following complications from a stroke. Over her lifetime, she wrote 37 novels, some that were turned into films, miniseries, and even a Broadway musical. Rights to all the vampire novels and witch novels have been sold to AMC, with Interview with the Vampire currently in production for release later this year. And her final novel, Ramses the Damned, The Reign of Osiris, co-written with her son Christopher, will be released later this year as well. There's a plan for a huge, yet-to-be-announced memorial ceremony later this year in New Orleans, where she'll be buried. I hope I can attend.
What, they didn't announce when, though?
No, Christopher's still planning it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're going to try to go?
Yeah. I would love to. It's going to be a freak party.
Oh, you know it.
Yeah.
You're going to fit right in. In a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. In a good way.
So is that the history?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to veer off so much. However, do you talk about during this episode or any of your stories why she meant so much to you personally?
Yeah.
You do?
I will.
Okay. Okay. Just making sure, because I want people to know about this, because she did have a huge impact on you that you've talked about to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's why Chris's hair is pink.
No.
And why he changed his own name to Christopher.
Oh, yeah.
Christopher.
Whatever.
Because his name used to be...
I know. Coincidences.
Gene.
Gene Chavez.
Gene Chavez.
Eugene. Could you imagine me as a Eugene?
I kind of can.
You look more like a Eugene.
What?
I
no,
do.
I don't.
It's the glasses.
It's Clint.
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 Oh, it's the glasses. Yeah, dude. All right. So stories?
Yeah.
Okay. So I kind
I thought you were going to take off your hat and look at you and be like...
Throw it down. Yeah. Get ready. These stories are super cool and interesting because it's eclectic. Now, I admit, I had to reach out to Chris. I did it via text and I was like, so,
what
other
she
than
write
vampires,
about?
What did she write about?
And pretty much everything. She wrote about ghosts, werewolves, angels, Jesus as a young child, witches, mummies, etc., etc.
Yep.
Erotica.
So Chris did say, when I'm going to talk about, I actually am going to talk about something to do with mummies. Because I'd realized we've talked about kind of the basic classic monsters, but we've never ever discussed mummies. Mm-hmm. And when you look about at mummy stuff, there's some interesting shit out there.
Oh, yeah, there is.
So story number one, I'm calling King Tut's curse.
Mm-hmm.
All
I've heard of his curse in certain people.
I think most people have.
Yeah.
But this is kind of the full story that I had no idea.
It's fascinating.
It's really cool. So because the ancient Egyptians saw their pharaohs as gods, they carefully preserved their bodies after death, burying them in elaborate tombs containing rich treasures to accompany the rulers into the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
In the 19th century, archaeologists from all over the world flocked to Egypt, where they uncovered a number of these tombs, only to discover that many had long ago been broken into by robbers and stripped of their riches.
And I think that we've heard a lot about that, which I think is so interesting.
Absolutely.
Now, when English archaeologist Howard Carter arrived in Egypt in 1891, he became convinced there was at least one undiscovered tomb, someone that had been unraided and was, you know, clean, that of the little-known Tutankhamun, or King Tut, who lived around 1400 BC and died when he was still a teenager. Backed by a rich Brit.
Yeah, I don't
Brit,
think people lived very long back then. Maybe no. To their 20s.
Yeah, like he was considered old when he was like 16. Backed by a rich Brit, Lord Carnarvon, Carter searched for 5 years.
Carnivore.
That's what I was trying to say. I was like, wait, what? Carter searched for 5 years without success. In early 1922, Lord Carnarvon wanted to call off the search, but Carter convinced him to hold on for one more year. Hold on for one more year. In November of 1922, the wait paid off when Carter's team found steps hidden in the debris near the entrance of another tomb.
Isn't that crazy?
It's so crazy. The steps led to an ancient sealed doorway bearing the name Tutankhamun. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine just seeing this, your excitement? Like, this has been here all along,
I'm
and
sure
we just missed
it. I'm sure
it
didn't say Tutankhamun like in English. It was in hieroglyphics. Yeah.
It's like, hi, what's up?
Because it's not like they instantly recognized it was his name. They probably had to decipher it.
Yes, I'm sure. It wasn't like Tutankhamun, it was yeeted here.
They didn't have a Google translator back then.
Yeah, if only they had it now. Now, I didn't actually realize that Tutankhamun was kind of just an unknown. Like, because you hear about the pharaohs, that's the first one that always pops into our head, but only because of this. Mm-hmm. But he was just kind of a nobody. Now, when Carter and Lord Carnarvon entered the tomb's interior chambers on November 26th, they were thrilled to find it virtually intact, with its treasures untouched after more than 3,000 years.
Yep.
The men began exploring the four rooms of the tomb, and on February 16th of 1923, under the watchful eyes of a number of officials, Carter opened the door to the last chamber. Wow. Inside lay a sarcophagus with three coffins nested inside one another.
Oh, like a Russian nesting doll?
Exactly, which is so weird. The last coffin, made of solid gold, contained the mummified body of King Tut. Mm. So it's all so cool. But that's where their problems began. There were people who believe that ancient building techniques, literature, art, and mathematics derived from an alien culture from outer space. And I think we've talked about that. Yeah.
It's like ancient alien shit.
Yeah, it's the ancient alien shit. This and other equally inaccurate theories are espoused by people fondly referred to by Egyptologists as pyramidiots.
Pyramidians. Awesome.
So we got to start using that. But while some modern ideas about Egypt are based on a mixture of misguided awe and respect, others appear to have originated under less innocent circumstances. And one of the most persistent is the so-called curse of the pharaohs. Mm-hmm. Now, the curse of the pharaohs, or the mummy's curse, is a curse alleged to be cast upon anyone who disturbs the mummy of an ancient Egyptian, especially a pharaoh.
Or who takes anything from their tomb, like jewelry, a coin, anything.
Anything pilfered, taken.
That's attached to them in some way.
That's exactly right. Now, this curse, which does not differentiate between thieves and archaeologists. So they're saying, even if your motives are pure and you're not trying to steal, we don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And it's claimed to cause bad luck, illness, or even death. Mm-hmm. Now, this may sound like a bunch of woo, and that's what I would say. However, when you look at what happened to those involved with King Tut, you may change your mind. Mm-hmm. There were so many people connected in some way to the opening of the tomb who experienced some sort of tragedy right after the tomb's opening. And so there were so many that I just had to comb through, and I found
some of the craziest ones.
So I'm going to read through this. So number one, George Herbert, 5th Earl of Carnarvon. So this is the guy who financed the whole thing.
Yeah.
He was the first to come to the come from the curse.
Wow.
C-U-M.
That's some curse.
That's some curse. He was the first to succumb. He accidentally tore open a mosquito bite while shaving and ended up dying of blood poisoning. This is right after the unearthing of the tomb.
That is awful.
Yeah.
Could you imagine having a little bump on your skin and cutting that off?
And then getting blood poisoning and dying.
Yeah.
Which is so wild, because we all get mosquito bites, and I'm sure we've all scratched them to the point where they break open or bleed, but he died from it. Number two, Sir Bruce Ingham. Howard Carter, the archaeologist who discovered the tomb, gave a paperweight to his friend Bruce Ingham as a gift. Mm-hmm. The paperweight consisted of a mummified hand wearing a bracelet that was supposedly inscribed with the phrase, cursed be he who moves my body.
Wow.
As soon as he arrived home with the gift, his house burned to the ground.
Yeah.
George J. Gould was a wealthy American financier and railroad executive who visited the tomb in 1923 with everyone. Mm-hmm. He died of pneumonia right after. Aaron Ember, who was another Egyptologist, was present when the tomb was opened, died when his house in Baltimore burned down and this he was inside.
Fucking insane.
Richard Bethell, who was Lord Carnarvon's secretary and the first person behind Carter to enter the tomb, mm-hmm. was found smothered in his room at an elite London gentleman's club right after. One wow. modern historian has attributed his death to the work of a Satanist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Sir Archibald Douglas Reed, a radiologist, x-rayed Tut before the mummy was given to museum authorities. Mm-hmm. He got sick the next day and died 3 days later.
Oh, shit.
And finally, and this is, I have this as number five, so I reordered mine because mm-hmm. it's clearly, there's like number 10. Hugh Evelyn White was a British archaeologist, visited King Tut's tomb, and may have helped excavate the site. After seeing death sweep over about two dozen of his fellow excavators by 1924, which is 1 year later, he killed himself.
Oh, shit.
But not before writing, allegedly in his own blood, "I have succumbed to a curse which forces me to disappear."
Wow.
And that is the story of the curse of King Tut.
I was going to ask you if you believe in it, but I'll wait till
talk about it. Isn't that wild, though?
Yeah.
Could you imagine watching two dozen of your fellows just in 1 year, death, 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 death?
I mean, you're going to talk about a debug, but what else could it be related to be? Because it's all related to that, you know?
Yep. Or so it seems.
Yeah. So it seems.
Yeah. Oh, I love that story. Yeah, and my next one is just as interesting.
Yeah. So like I said, Anne Rice wrote about all kinds of supernatural creatures, but was probably most well known for her vampire chronicles. So my first story comes from Guadalajara, Mexico, about a vampire legend from sometime in the 1800s. That's what all is. This one actually has a 2-for-1. So two legends within one.
Okay.
In the rural streets of Guadalajara, an unknown tall man who was said to wear cloaks and mostly appearing after dark...
Was it me?
...began appearing.
Oh.
Not too long after his appearance, livestock, pets, and children began turning up dead. Not only that, they were completely drained of blood.
Oh.
Of course, rumors began to spread, stating that the man had something to do with it. The locals would eventually give him the nickname El Vampiro. People were scared and would hesitate to travel at night, if at all. After the body count began to rise, a vampire hunting vigilante was created. The mob would gather whatever weapons they could find and go to El Vampiro's home to take matters into their own hands.
Oh, God. Okay.
Shortly after the mob found El Vampiro, they drove a stake through his heart while he laid in bed.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Without any final rites, his body was thrown into a crypt at a local cemetery called El Panteón de Belén. Legend has it that following this, El Vampiro's blood was sucked into the earth, which then caused a massive twisted tree to grow up out of the tomb, break through the earth, and completely cover El Vampiro's grave. The legend goes that...
Who saw the blood seeping out and doing all this shit?
I say it's a legend.
Okay.
The legend goes that El Vampiro's spirit and essence has permeated the creepy tree so much so that when the tree is cut, blood rather than sap will come out.
Damn.
It is also said that over the years, if the tree pushes El Vampiro's grave to the surface, he would gain new life and would be able to return to his old habits and also take revenge on those who killed him.
Wow, this would be a great book.
A movie, yeah.
Could you imagine, what if the locals are all like every day just watching him to make sure that it's not rising?
Well, this
rising.
Was in the 1800s. So, oh.
Yeah. Well, is it still there?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
So that is that legend. Now let's fast forward to a century later in the 1900s.
Okay.
There was a little girl named Maria who, upon hearing the legend, started to become fascinated with the twisted tree. Yearly during Dia de los Muertos festivals, El Panteón de Belén became pretty popular for people to go to that cemetery. During this time, Maria would make her way to El Vampiro's tree, wondering if the legends were true. When she got a few years older, at the age of 11, she decided to explore the grave with nothing but a candle lamp.
Wait, so she became fascinated when she's like 9?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Despite the warnings of not to play in the area, Maria still decided to go. When she reached the tree, she saw that it had been vandalized and there had been attempts to cut through it. El Vampiro's crypt was still visible, but with age and cracked and looked like nothing more than a slab of concrete. She looked closer at the grave with her small light, and with that decided to go into the opening that was there.
Oh, girl.
This is a crypt rather than like a coffin, you know.
This 11-year-old's braver than me now.
Yeah. The tomb was not very large, and within there was an aged metal casket.
Oh, my God. And she... What the... Girl, run!
There was some writing that had been corroded with age. As she tried to read the writing, she suddenly felt something touch her leg. Looking down, she could see that there was a small hole in the casket.
Oh!
Curiously, she looked in and could see that something was moving about, but could not make out what it was. Her fear got the best of her, and she ran out of the tomb. Hell yeah.
Yeah, right.
In doing so, she hit her head with a wound producing a small amount of blood. She somehow felt deep in her being that it was El Vampiro. Maria ran home in fear with the feeling that she had been followed. Not only that, she thought whatever was in that tomb had a taste for her blood and wanted more. Despite her fear, she was able to get to sleep. The next day, she was still trying to figure out what exactly had happened. The night after the incident, after she fell asleep, she woke up to see the figure of a tall man sitting in her room and a spot of blood on her pillow.
Wow. So he appeared?
Yeah.
Okay.
She screamed, alarming her parents and driving the figure out of her room. The next night, the same thing would happen. Her parents believed that it was all, or at least they thought it was all in her imagination. Her mom agreed to stay with her that night, and wouldn't you know it, the figure did not return that night or the next. Remember her little cut? Well, it didn't seem to be healing, which freaked her out. She was taken to the doctor, who couldn't find a reason for the cut not closing, and then sent her home. After going to sleep, wouldn't you know it, the figure returned only after her mother had left the room to go to the bathroom. Upon mom's return, she also saw the figure looming over Maria's bed. Hearing this, the figure turned to her, and she saw that he had glowing eyes and sharp teeth. The creature retreated with superhuman strength into the night, with the parents now believing...
Wait. Superhuman, not speed, but strength?
Oh, yeah. I meant speed.
Oh.
Yeah. Like the Hulk.
Yeah, I'm stronger than the night.
Yeah. With the parents now believing her, they asked for help from a local minister. The minister put holy water on Maria's wound and prayed over the bedroom to no avail. Things started moving around the room, so the minister started an exorcism, which only made the power angrier. A mist formed in the shape of a man, which the minister rebuked. This time it worked. All was calm again. Following the incident, all went back to normal. Maria's wound healed, and the creature never again returned. Sometime after, the tree was cut down, and the casket and its contents were destroyed. So if you ever happen to visit Guadalajara, be sure to stop at El Panteón de Belén and see if you have your own encounter.
I can't even speak to this. Like, I'm speechless. Okay, is this real?
It's supposedly.
Like, you know? Is this verifiable that this Maria is a real person and she really had this seance, like this stuff supposedly happened, or
in
all that
research,
is?
I can't really find, like, if they don't say if it's true.
Because holy shit, that's crazy.
Isn't it cool?
No, that's awesome. I did not expect that. I was literally, I usually will say stuff, but I was like, if you couldn't see me, I was just like,
yeah, just my when mouth you think open. It's over, something else happens. Yeah. And it keeps on going.
You know? Oh man. Okay. So if you go there now, you can't see the Mm-mm. any of it. Okay. Okay. Now, is it proven that this grave actually did exist at some point?
Yeah. I think the grave is still there.
Okay. Okay. With okay.
We'll have to look up pictures because I think there is pictures. Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna look. We can post them.
Hey, what's up, you guys?
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Haley.
And we are Saturdays Are for the Ghouls,
a podcast on the Podmoth Network.
We cover all things spooky, like horror movies, true crime, the supernatural, and spooky stories.
In the most chaotic way possible.
So join your favorite ghoul friends every Saturday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And become a spooky babe.
So spooky babes, we'll see you
in your nightmares.
Yeah. All right. Still recovering. So next, I'm going to be talking about, well...
Anne Rice wrote some Sleeping Beauty erotica.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Sleeping Beauty erotica. Mm-hmm. I love it.
It's a trilogy.
A trilogy. Okay. So I was like, you know, that's actually kind of different and interesting. So I went and started looking up some true weird stories about sleep. Uh-huh. And I found this one that I want to share that is so crazy. It's so wild.
I'm excited for this one because I know absolutely nothing or
oh, good.
To talk about.
And this is, I actually have two different stories. Time permitting, I might share the second one. But the first one I'm calling Sleepy Hollow.
Okay.
You know how, like, when you hear Sleepy Hollow, you think about Ichabod Crane, mm-hmm. and because Sleepy Hollow was a town.
It's in New York.
Yeah, the Headless upstate. Horseman, upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And side note, did you know I actually played Ichabod Crane?
No, in I could see that.
Like a version of Sleepy Hollow.
Like a virgin.
I was a virgin. you said version.
Yeah, because you just like said a version. Like a version.
Well done. So it was terrible, but I was actually fun in it. It was yeah. It was awful though. It was silly, but Sleepy Hollow is actually a real thing, mm-hmm. and it's not a place. It's a condition.
Oh, what?
Sleepy Hollow is a possible medical disease in humans, causing them to sleep for days or weeks at a time. And I found this. Yeah, so I found this on Wikipedia talking about this,
like a coma.
Except it's just sleep. I don't know. Because here, listen to this. Ugh, this is the truly crazy thing. The disease has only ever been reported one time.
What?
In a remote village in Kazakhstan.
Borat.
Borat. Borat had Sleepy Hollow. And this is not like 1600s. This is in 2013. Oh, wow. So in 2013.
So this is a newly discovered condition.
Yes, but only in this one place. So in 2013, the residents of Kalachi, a small village in Kazakhstan, began to take to their beds with a mysterious quote-unquote illness. They couldn't stop falling asleep. When they woke up, often days later, they remembered nothing. Mm-hmm. Newspapers called it a sleeping sickness, mm-hmm. but unrelated to the African sleeping sickness transmitted by flies, and multiple investigations into the causes. They looked into the patients' ages, the schedules, the town's air quality, the food and water, and everything that they were eating, turned up nothing. Mm-hmm. So the first reported case of the sleeping sickness came actually in 2010 in a neighboring village. In 2013, the mystery took on new urgency as 8 different people from Kalachi, and it was a town of just 640, fell asleep over one weekend, unable to stay awake for any longer than it took to go to the bathroom. When these otherwise healthy adults finally awoke from their sleep, they didn't remember anything that happened, even the times when they had seemed awake enough to maybe just have a bite or go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So, and BuzzFeed actually reported all this during a week-long investigative trip to the region. So people are actually going there and investigating this. One man even woke up unable to remember being on a plane that brought him there earlier.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So these people, though, sometimes felt nauseous and dizzy. Some of them around the sleep time hallucinated, mm-hmm. ranting about images only they could see, yeah. and then even becoming violent. Now, it started off with 8 people, but in this town of 640, Yeah, well, more than 100 people of the 640
That's definitely
eventually
a lot.
reported the sleeping disorder. Even a cat was affected.
It's cats like definitely sleep a lot. 18 hours a day.
I know. Like how do you know? Yeah. They all have Sleepy Hollow. So this happened again and again over the course of several months, with waves of residents falling prey to the sickness in the beginning of 2014, and then later that spring, and then again that summer.
Was there a gas leak in the town?
So that's so, they said, like, they even did air quality checks and all this. The nearby uranium mines, people thought that was a culprit. So scientists went, tested the earth, mm-hmm. the water, food again for radon, a gas known to cause cancer. The yeah. air was tested for carbon monoxide, of which course. Is something you think is a really common thing. Mm-hmm. People's hair and fingernails were tested. Doctors could find nothing wrong with the patients and no factors to link them together than the fact that they lived in this town. So finally then, in the summer of 2015, some authorities announced they finally discovered the culprit, and they actually said it was high concentrations of carbon monoxide and hydrocarbons coming mm-hmm. from the mines, okay. causing a lack of oxygen in the area. Now, by the time the announcement came in the summer of 2015, 150 people had already moved away, while another 240 were on a list of people seeking resettlement. So that's like half this whole little town.
That's crazy.
Still, experts who had been studying the outbreak said that this verdict was only a working theory, mm-hmm. and that researchers were still studying the medical anomaly, and they really couldn't truly explain it.
Yeah, if you hadn't explained that, my other theory would have been maybe it's like some genetic disorder.
Yeah, and but they said like nothing, like they were looking for links, and yeah. I guess I'm sure genetics was one to tie these people together, and they couldn't find anything.
That's an insane
so
story.
So that is the story of Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, well, let me follow up with this.
Okay.
So my second story is not exactly paranormal, but so interesting that I had to talk about it.
Okay.
Anne Rice may have been known for her supernatural creatures, but between Interview with the Vampire and her second vampire novel, she wrote a few books, one being the gorgeous novel called Cry to Heaven, which I highly recommend, in which she wrote a fictionalized account of the Italian castrati.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Castrato, or pluralized castrati, were the result of an extremely unethical practice in which boys were castrated before puberty to preserve their singing voices. This practice was quite popular in 17th century Italy. In castrating a cisgender male, this will slow down hormone production, which means the boy's larynx would not transform as it does in a normal bout of puberty. This would then mean that the affected person's vocal range would be mostly retained. This was not the only side effect of the mutilation. The lack of testosterone caused bone joints not to harden, so their limbs and ribs would grow unusually long.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. On the plus side, a trained castrato singer had insane lung power and breathing capacity.
And they were kind of seen as celebrities, right?
Kind of, but also shunned because of their weird looks and effeminity.
True.
The process, of course, was painful, and to prevent some of the pain, the male child children were given high doses of opium or other available narcotics. Some children would die due to the lethal doses of narcotics or by the compression of the carotid artery of the neck for too long, which was meant to make them unconscious.
Oh, my God.
This practice preceded 17th century Italy, dating back to ancient Sumer. Then they would were called eunuch singers. In that time, castration was used as a form of domination, enslavement, and or punishment. It is not clear how the practice made a reappearance in Italy. There's no like link there, I'm not sure, but it just did, you know. There, they became the castrati became popular in very early opera. For example, in Monteverdi's Orfeo, written in 1607, castrati had smaller roles, which in modern times would be considered pants roles or roles played by women dressed as boys. Eventually, castrato would play more prominent roles in opera. As it was said, an Italian opera that didn't have at least one fabulous castrato was doomed to fail. So-called serious operas were known to favor the high voices of castrati, which within the show would symbolize heroic virtue. That being said, spectators would often make fun of them for the way they looked or for their terrible acting skills. Castrati training was super intense, singing very difficult pieces for hours a day, as well as studying music theory, counterpoint, and so on. The practice, this practice came to its pinnacle during the 1720s and 30s, and it has been said that 4,000 or more boys were castrated annually for this purpose.
Holy shit. Despite, I wonder if it was like against some of their will or if they volunteered to do this.
Well, also, poor families, they would think about making money.
That's true. Know? That's
so
true.
That was part of it, too. Despite their popularity, castrati also fell upon lots of abuse, often being blamed for luring men into homosexuality. Thankfully, by the late 18th century, taste in opera and social attitude began to change, causing a decline in the desire for castrati. The fact that it lasted so long is fucking unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Finally, in 1861, the practice was made illegal, and in 1878, the Pope prohibited castrati to be hired to sing in the church. And in 1902, Pope Leo ruled that no further castrati should be admitted, period.
Good.
There are many famous castrati, such as Farinelli, who was said to be one of the greatest singers in the history of opera, having a soprano vocal range and was able to sing the highest note written during that period.
Shit.
In 1994, an international biographical film was released about Farinelli. Then there was Alessandro Moreschi, who was said to be one of the last castrati to survive, passing away in 1922 at the age of 63. Moreschi was given the nickname the Angel of Rome at the beginning of his career, and in modern times has been named the Last Castrato. Although later in life and towards the end of his career, Moreschi made the only known available recordings of a castrato in 1902 and 1904.
Wow.
Technology was not what it is today, but despite that, it is amazing that we can listen to a small snippet of at least one castrati. The recordings are fuzzy, but I was able to find one in which the static was removed, and you can hear the pain and despair in his voice. Remember that this was when he was older, so you can only imagine what he sounded like in his prime. And here we go. This is Ave Maria. Go a small snippet.
Wow.
You can find other recordings of other songs on YouTube. Like I said, it's beautiful and heartbreaking. And there you have the fascinating history of the castrati.
Wow. Oh, that was, that sound is just so
haunting.
There you go. That is such a good way to put it. Okay, so believer, skeptic.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to be focusing on King Tut's curse.
Okay.
Because I found three really interesting little tidbits that I wanted to share. First, all the fabrications and exaggerations described in my story as I burp neglect 2 points. The first is that there may well have been some natural phenomena in Tut's tomb that could cause disease, for example, mold or spores. It is a fact that paleopathologists and microbiologists now suggest that mummies may be examined by people wearing gloves and masks to prevent the spread of any infection. Indeed, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran an article on the topic entitled Thesis, Fungi, Not a Curse.
Fungi.
Not a Curse, Killing the Finders of King Tut's Tomb.
Yeah.
Now, I had first. I don't have a second for that. I just cut it out.
Oh, that's all good.
So anyway, so that's the first tidbit.
Come up with your own theory.
Well, I have two more other things that are unrelated,
yeah.
But I don't know what the second part of that was. I'm like red. I'm blushing.
Copy paste.
Number two. Now, this is really cool. Not only did Howard Carter himself, notice I didn't mention his name, live to the fairly, especially for that time, the ripe old age of 64. But Sergeant Richard Adamson, a member of the team who guarded the chamber round the clock for 7 years, lived until 1982, and he was 400 years old.
Oh,
just kidding. I actually didn't record his age. But he's not alone. One expert notes, in actuality, if you look at the entire group of anyone who came in contact, the group died at the average age of 73, beating the actuarial tables for persons of that period by about a year. So the curse of the pharaoh is actually a beneficial curse, it seems. Not that that was super. So it talked about the people who died, but not about the plethora of people who survived without anything going on.
Or they also didn't talk about like how long it took to die in between each person.
That's true. That's true. Now, finally, the origin of the curse may not be what you expected. According to one expert, when Tut's tomb was discovered and opened in 1922, it was a major event in order to keep the press at bay and yet allow kind of a sensational aspect. The head of the excavation team put out a story that a curse had been placed upon anyone who violated the rest of the boy king. Now, that was Carter himself, and he did not invent the idea of the curse, but he did exploit it to keep intruders away from his discovery.
Wow.
Yeah.
So those are cool theories.
So that means you believe in the curse?
I mean, I kind of can believe in curses.
Yeah?
I don't know specifically that one, but I mean, if think about like indigenous land too and stuff like that, you fuck with it, something's gonna happen.
Something can come back to you, sure. Yeah. But this is what debunkers say is an explanation. So I'm curious about your believer.
I know now it's the believer portion that you are usually used to hearing. In lieu of that, I've decided to write a tribute to Anne Rice. I remember picking up Interview with the Vampire in high school, the first novel of hers that I would read and come to love. Since that time, I have read a majority of her novels. Since I was younger, I had always been fascinated by vampires, and her vampires were the most beautiful, pained, ethereal creatures I'd read about. I was still unsure of my sexuality at the time, but reading the homoeroticism within her books comforted me and made me feel seen. It is said that her novels are well received by much of the LGBTQ community, who have perceived her vampires as an allegory for isolation and social alienation, much like how I myself felt growing up. When asked about that, Anne said that, quote, "From the beginning, I've had gay fans and gay readers who felt that my works involved a sustained gay allegory. I didn't set out to do that, but that is the way they perceived it. So even with when Christopher was a little baby, I had gay readers and gay friends and knew gay people and lived in the Castro district of San Francisco, which was a gay neighborhood," unquote. That being said, she has was always a huge support for the LGBTQ community, which was inclusive of her gay son, Christopher. He said in an interview following her death that she used vampires, witches, and werewolves to explore, quote, "great cosmic spiritual questions about identity and belonging." The night she died, I was distraught. A number of my heroes died in 2021, but this one hit me the hardest. She taught me that it was okay to be who I was, that it was okay to be a little dark and to embrace all that I was. I met her at book signings on three separate occasions, and she was always patient and kind, staying far beyond the end time to greet every fan, sign their books, and take pictures with them.
And this is when she was, like, old, even.
Yeah, in her 70s. On the night of her passing, Christopher said it best in his Facebook post, quote, "Let us take comfort in the shared hope that Anne is now experiencing firsthand the glorious answers to many great spiritual and cosmic questions, the quest for which defined her life and career," unquote. Anne made an impact not just on me, but the world. It has been said that she always decried fashion and forged her own path. She paved the way for many supernatural authors of today. To me, she was the queen of modern Gothic literature. And because she lived, because she wrote, because she died, she changed my life. You'll live forever in my mind and my heart. Long live Queen Anne.
That was really nice.
Thanks.
I feel like I kind of know her now.
Yeah.
After all this, which I think is amazing.
It's the whole point of this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So,
well, I think because of that beautiful tribute, we're going to leave off. We're not going to do a creep of the week.
Yeah.
Right. And leave off there.
And with just our sign off. So yeah. Thank you for holding out on us and waiting for us. We are back and we are going to come to you full swing. So if you aren't already, you can find us on all your podcatchers. Follow us, download, subscribe. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at BSPodPHX. And if you have any stories of your own or any encounters, anything like that, you can email them to BSPodPHX@gmail.com.
Yay. And if you are, in fact, a reader and like things with LGBT themes, my books, The Gay Teen's Guide to Defeating a Siren, as always, are available. And with that, I think you said it beautifully, so I don't think there's anything else to say. So everyone, we hope you enjoyed this tribute, and bye!
See you again next time.